You have to go all the way to the top of the hill before we can rest.
Oh, yes.
Oh, what a way to spend a Sunday.
Oh, here, sit down on this nice big boulder.
It's times like this that I wonder why I ever married a geologist. Well, I don't even understand what you're up to.
Well, it'll be a great thing for glacial geology if I can prove that there was a post-glacial lake around here. And what's more,
Timothy,
I see indicate...
Timothy.
Yes?
Didn't you say that building we passed a while ago is an asylum?
Well, yes, dear, but
come on, Timothy, get down behind this boulder.
Here, what on earth is the idea?
Quiet. Now, here, crouch down behind this boulder.
All right.
Oh, Timothy, what makes you wear such funny clothes?
Well, what do my clothes have to do with it? What is the idea of hiding?
There were two men in white coats sneaking up the path after us.
White coats?
Yes, they must think we're inmates.
Inmates?
I told you not to peer at people the way you do.
Well...
I warned you not to wear that orange and black blazer. I told you to cut off some of that beard.
Well, now my beard is my...
Wait till I peek and see if they're still coming.
Oh, this is the silliest...
Don't say a word. They'll find us.
Evidently, the everyday life of those who investigate the past can have its moments. But the life of the archaeologist is more apt to be full of such discomforts as heat, sand, wind, and so on. Such was the lot of Dr. Nelson Glick, at any rate. Dr. Glick is director of the American School of Oriental Research at Jerusalem. And Dr. Glick's investigations, so Emerson Markham tells me, led to the discovery of Solomon's Seaport. Right, Emerson?
Right, Bab.
Solomon's Seaport. Now, I imagine most of us think of Solomon particularly in connection with wisdom.
Yes, that's probably the case, Bob. The discovery of Solomon's naval base at the head of the Red Sea gives us different ideas about Solomon. His fabulous wisdom and wealth have been bywords for well nigh 3,000 years. And the uncovering of the buried seaport of Ezi and Geber has produced information which, for the first time, reveals Solomon as a great copper king and makes him stand out preeminently as a merchant prince.
Merchant prince? Oh, that's interesting. And it was Dr. Glick's archaeological expedition which uncovered the buried seaport?
Yes, Bob, it was. Ezi and Geber's main importance was as the gateway to Arabia. A fragment of a South Arabian inscription originally carved on a jar was found at Ezi and Geber, the first of its kind ever discovered in a dated excavation. Another pottery fragment and numerous jar handles were found on which were stamped the names of Edomite personages in Edomite Hebrew language in which the Book of Job was originally written. Indeed, in such a central point such as Ezi and Geber, a veritable babel of languages must have prevailed, with many different scripts being used.
By the way, is this still an important spot?
Well, today, when the head of the Red Sea has great potential commercial, military, and naval importance, the sleepy little village of Aqaba, which has replaced Ezi and Geber several miles west of it, is the only market and trading place in many miles, not only for southernmost Palestine and Transjordan, but also for northeastern Sinai and northwestern Hejaz, and Saudi Arabia. King Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia is fully aware of the importance of Aqaba and has never given up his claims to it.
And Solomon must have realized what a strategic port it was from what you've already said.
Yes, it was with much reason that Solomon paid so much attention to the development of Ezi and Geber and that his successors fought so furiously when necessary to maintain their control over it. In all likelihood, it was in such inscribed jars as those found in Ezi and Geber that the Queen of Sheba conveyed the precious spices she presented to Solomon.
By the way, Emerson, where is Sheba?
In southern Arabia, Bob, about 1,200 miles from Jerusalem. It was a long and wearisome journey, and the Queen did not undertake it merely as an elaborate courtesy to a foreign power. The rich spice trade between Arabia and Palestine was the underlying reason for this memorable trip. The cementing of the Jerusalem-Ophir axis, the immediate purpose behind the amenities of the meeting of the two monarchs.
And a memorable meeting it was, if I remember rightly.
Indeed it was. Political bargains and trade advantages were the subjects of the conversations. It is evident that an equitable agreement was arrived at, for we are told that King Solomon gave to the Queen of Sheba all that it pleased her to ask, besides that which he gave her according to his royal bounty.
Which was probably considerable, but I'd like to have a little information right here as to when all this took place.
Well, Solomon acceded to the throne in Jerusalem about 970 B.C. With his accession, a new era began for the young state. Under his autocratic rule of almost 40 years, it was to grow greatly in power and affluence.
He must have had a really strong personality.
Well, he was only a youth of 12 at his accession, and much of the credit for his early successes must be given to his capable and beautiful mother, Bathsheba. Largely because of her influence with David, Solomon's candidacy for the throne succeeded in spite of the prior claims of his eldest surviving half-brother, Adonijah. But certainly with her knowledge and probably at her instigation, Solomon immediately crushed all of his adversaries. Henceforth, no real opposition manifested itself against Solomon, no matter how much his subjects suffered from his increasingly oppressive reign.
Oh, he was really a dictator.
Oh, my, yes. But in the long run, Solomon's strength proved to be his weakness and made for the undoing of his country.
Somehow that doesn't sound so wise.
As a matter of fact, his wealth and wisdom and statesmanship were of no real avail to his people, because while they brought glamour and power and pageantry to Israel, the general standard of living among the masses was lowered. A system of actual serfdom was introduced. The seeds of disunion and bitter civil war were sown, and the overrunning of the country by foreign powers was made inevitable. In fact, the day after his death, practically, his kingdom fell apart. About 5 years later, the magnificent temple he had erected at Jerusalem was plundered by Shishak, the reigning pharaoh of Egypt.
Well, that's quite an enlightening picture you've drawn for us, Emerson.
Well, thanks to Dr. Greatfat. Well,
anyway, it puts Solomon in something of a different light from the one in which most of us probably have imagined him. How about telling us how Solomon arrived at the place where he could be called a merchant prince?
Well, at the beginning of his reign, Solomon's task was that of consolidating the gains that David had made. He inherited a kingdom which included all of the area in the political boundaries of modern Palestine. Solomon made no attempt to enlarge his domains. He sought only to protect and to develop them. He wisely had no taste for war. By a series of astute political and matrimonial alliances, he secured his borders from all danger of attack.
So he could settle down to business in peace?
Precisely. His pro-Arabian policy was natural in view of the fact that in Araba, the section between the Dead Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba, along the eastern border of his kingdom, lay great deposits of copper and iron, as Dr. Glick's recent explorations have shown.
And what did his excavations tell about the ores?
Well, the ores, which were mined and partly roasted in the Araba, were further refined in the great smelting plant at Ezion-Geber, which was discovered during the excavations there.
A smelting plant? What is it like?
It was placed with its double rows of flues and interconnecting air channels squared in the path of the powerful winds which blow continuously southward. The smelting plant used by Solomon's engineers could be operated without a crude bellows system. Dr. Glick says that it incorporated technical features which have only been surpassed in modern times.
That really is amazing. What else did they uncover?
At Ezion-Geber, too, the excavation showed that there was manufactured a large variety of metal objects, ranging from copper dishes to spears and fish hooks. Quantities of copper were used in the construction of the temple and the palace in Jerusalem, but much of it must have served as Solomon's main export article and as his merchant's chief stock in trade.
Quite difficult to imagine all that activity going on way back then.
Yes, nevertheless it did, Bob. And it required a great organizing ability, much capital, a dynamic personality to integrate all those activities, ranging from the mining and the smelting of ores in the Araba to refining them, producing the finished articles, and exporting them by camel caravan and by ship to Arabia in exchange for the precious products obtainable there.
And that, no doubt, is where Solomon's seaport came in very handy.
Yes, indeed it did. It was part of Solomon's acumen to take full advantage of the sea route from Ezion-Geber to Ophir. At Ezion-Geber, we are told in the first book of Kings, he made a fleet of ships, which once in 3 years came in bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, peacocks, and a very great amount of red sandalwood and precious stones.
The great Solomon certainly had a number of irons in the fire, didn't he?
It didn't stop there either, Bob. His copper and shipping interests, coupled with his role as importer of spices and other precious products of Arabia, do not by any means exhaust the list of his major activities of commercial importance. As a result of his immensely successful undertakings, the comparatively little kingdom he ruled over became a first-rate power among the nations in the ancient Near East. Its importance was altogether out of proportion to its size.
Can you tell us other things which Dr. Glick found Solomon interested himself in from his excavations on Solomon's old stamping ground?
Well, Solomon had hardly established himself firmly on the throne when he embarked upon a great system of public works, which extended throughout the length and the breadth of the land.
Well, that sounds quite modern.
Yes, but not in the way he did it. To carry out his program, he didn't hesitate to draft thousands of his subjects into compulsory labor battalions. The resplendent temple in Jerusalem was built, also a new palace and fortifications for the city. Key fortresses were erected or strengthened throughout the country. Store cities set up to preserve great supplies for emergencies, huge barracks to house the standing army, and great stables for the chariots and the horses of his 12,000 cavalrymen.
Well, it's certainly understandable, in view of all of Solomon's industrial and commercial activities, that there was a remarkable economic development in Israel under him.
It is, Bob. Dr. Glick says that there is much yet to be learned about Solomon. The excavations we've mentioned here and others have taught us much concerning the kingdom and the person of Solomon.
Well, we're certainly thankful to you and to Dr. Glick and to the New York Times, which also published a story on Solomon's Seaport, for shedding new light on the great Solomon. Incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like a printed copy of the account you've just heard, which also includes some points we haven't covered here, all you have to do to receive a copy is address your request to Excursions in Science in care of the station to which you are listening, asking for scientific paper number 133, Solomon's Seaport. That's Solomon's Seaport, scientific paper number 133. And now, according to our custom, it's time for our question and answer period. The questions you are about to hear, ladies and gentlemen, were sent in by listeners, people like ourselves, laymen with an active scientific curiosity in the world about them. The answers they will receive will reflect the latest and most accurate information available, for they are based on information supplied by staff members of the General Electric Research Laboratory or of other equally reliable sources. Well, let's go, Emerson. And it's a good one. A gentleman asks, why is it that a kettle of boiling water is cooler on the bottom than the water inside or the fire underneath? It seems he experimented by actually touching, but not for long, the bottom of a kettle of boiling water.
Actually, the bottom of the kettle would be as hot as the boiling water, perhaps a little hotter, since the water gets its heat through the kettle bottom. And the fire is hotter than either, of course. When you touch the bottom, the skin of your hand makes contact with it in relatively few places, though.
But if you put your hand in the boiling water, the contact is much better, I suppose.
Exactly. And even though it may actually be a little cooler than the kettle bottom, the transfer of heat to your hand will be so much more efficient that you will have a nasty burn before you can pull your hand out.
In other words, if you put your hand into the boiling water, you will feel the heat.
Right. The fire underneath will, of course, be the hottest of the three. If you attempt to put your hand into the fire, well, you know the result.
Yes, but what prevents the water from getting as hot as the fire?
It's the heat of vaporization. You can add heat to cold water and raise its temperature until you get to the boiling point. And then the heat you add doesn't raise the temperature any farther, but is used to change the liquid into a gas. That's why boiling water is always the same temperature, no matter whether it's boiling rapidly or just simmering. If you can find the resultant steam and add heat, then the temperature will rise again.
Well, this next listener wants to know what alnico is.
That's an alloy of iron with aluminum, nickel, and cobalt, and hence the name alnico. It was developed for permanent magnets and is made in several forms. The latest is alnico 5. This is so potent that a small magnetized piece of alnico 5 will lift 70 times its own weight.
Isn't that what they used to get a lock out of a little boy's stomach not too long ago?
That's right. A boy in Brooklyn swallowed a little iron padlock, and its position was shown by X-rays. A special magnet of alnico 5 was made, and it was grooved to fit a stomach tube. When this was lowered into the boy's stomach, the lock stuck firmly to the magnet, and it was pulled up with no injury to the patient.
Next, a friend asks if there is any scientific method of locating buried treasure in the ground, say by rods or other means.
Well, there are methods, not by rod, but by electronic or magnetic means by which the presence of objects can be detected. This method is used for repairing water pipes, too, in certain sections of the country, and is much the same method employed by the Army in warfare for locating mines. The same technique is used for all these purposes, and that is by means of a coil of wire through which alternating current passes. A metal object changes the amount of current, and this is how it is located. Meteorites have been found by the use of this method, and so have shell fragments.
Our listener uses the word treasure, and you say that metal changes the amount of current. Does that mean that objects other than those of metal, such as jewels and so on, can't be found by this means?
That's right, but a similar method is employed in locating oil and mineral deposits in geophysical prospecting.
How deep can a metal object be buried in the ground and be detected by this electronic method?
Oh, about 10 or 12 feet.
Which, incidentally, is just about the distance we are from the studio door. We better be covering that distance right now, so I'll just say, thank you, Emerson Markham, and goodbye, everyone, until our next excursion in science.